Thank you, Carla and Ben, for that. Good morning, everyone. We are continuing down the Jesus path, and we've moved into Jesus baptism this morning. And the whole point of this series we're going to right till Easter is to showcase how the events of Jesus' life are not just things we're asked to witness or believe in, but that they function as a way of life, a path to travel. And so I want to dive into Jesus' baptism, second event, big event in his life, and it proves to be a marquee moment, I believe. And it starts, of course, with this odd ritual. Jesus takes himself to a river and has his cousin, John the Baptist, baptize him. And this ritual typically sees somebody go into a body of water, they're dunked back, and then they're brought up. That's the ritual, of course. And Jesus has this done to him. This event, though, to me, is more than just something, oh, hey, that's interesting, that happened to Jesus. It's an event that serves as a concrete way of living for us. It gives us a definitive way to see ourselves. And I believe it functions for us as a blessing prototype. Now, the contours of Jesus' path are revealed to us as we keep walking, but I want to showcase how I think this forms a way of life for us. But before we get there, I want us to put our thinking caps on this morning, because I want to pose two questions about four stories I want to give you this morning. So I want to tell you a series of four stories, and I want you to think about two questions. They're these. First, how would you respond if the people in the stories I'm about to tell you were in front of you and asked you, what is the meaning of this event? Second, if you were in their shoes, if this happened to you, what would you say the importance of these events was? Okay? So I'll give you four stories. I want you to ask yourself, what is the meaning of these events? What would you say the meaning was if it happened to you? So, story number one, Paul Vasquez was a quiet, simple man. He lived in a mountainous area just outside Yellowstone National Park. And again, he lived simply. He grew his own food. Most years, he existed off of $6,000 a year. But Paul would become famous overnight. In January of 2010, he noticed something while he was tending to his front yard. In front of him were a pair of brilliantly technicolored rainbows all across the horizon. And the event was so moving to him that he tried to capture it on film. Now, I want to show you, some of you will know this, this is Double Rainbow Man. I want to show you this clip because to me this is something that's just, I love it. It's a 2.5 minute clip. This is Paul Vasquez, Double Rainbow Man, responding on video to seeing a pair of rainbows, right?
Whoa, that's a full rainbow all the way. Double rainbow, oh my God. It's a double rainbow all the way. Whoa, that's so intense. Whoa, man. Wow. Whoa. 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 Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Woo. Oh wow. Woo. Yeah. Oh my God, look at that. It's starting to even look like a triple rainbow. Oh my God, it's full on. Double rainbow all the way across the sky. Oh my God. Oh my God. What does this mean? Oh my God. Oh God. It's so bright. Oh my God. It's so bright and vivid. Oh. so beautiful. God, it's a double complete rainbow. Oh, my front yard. Oh my God. Oh my God. What's it mean? Tell me. Too much. Tell me what it means.
Oh, I love that video deeply. I want to break it down for us a little bit this morning because the video is grainy, right? So whatever splendor he was seeing with the rainbows is lost to us. To me, the video is not actually about the double rainbows. I believe what Paul captured, though, is a firsthand account of what it sounds like in the moment when someone experiences something so wonderful it completely moves them. Now, I should clarify, Paul was asked, "Were you high when that happened?" And he responded, "I was not high." He said this, "I saw God, and I put it on video." And I love the way it breaks down, because initially when he sees the rainbows, we hear this sort of quiet awe. Then he comes around the corner, and he's moved just into complete celebration before he breaks down weeping into tears. And then he asks the question, "What does it mean?" And he weeps a little bit more, and then at the end of the video, "This is too much." He says, "What does it mean?" That's a good question, Paul. What does it mean? So here's my question for you. If Paul Vasquez was right here and said to you, "What does that mean?" What would you say? What would you say to him? What does it mean, Paul? Well, what would your answer be? We'll get back to him. Story number two. Paul Groshen, different Paul, he was working in the Chicago area, and he had started dating a woman named Esther. They had been out on about 8 dates, and Paul was like, "I don't know, maybe I should, you know, get more serious with her." And he was thinking about getting more serious. He decided to think about it over lunch. And so he goes out to lunch. He buys himself a $6 sandwich. As he's paying the cashier, he hands the cashier a 5 and a 1. But as he pulls out the 1, he notices something. On that $1 bill is the name Esther, the very person he was dating, the name of the person he was dating. He quickly, of course, puts the 1 back, gives a different 1, and then he takes this dollar bill and he's looking at it while he's eating a sandwich, and he's thinking to himself, "What does this mean?" And he decides, of course, over lunch, you know, "I do want to get more serious with Esther," and he comes up with an idea. He's going to frame the dollar bill and give it to his girlfriend Esther next time they go out on a date. That's what he does. They go out on their date. He says, "Hey, I want to get more serious. I've got this little present for you." Hands her the dollar bill, and Esther seems very weirded out by this dollar bill. And she agrees to get more serious with him, but is a little bit weirded out and says, "Remind me to tell you something later." Well, later turns out to be years. They end up married, they're moving, and finally they stumble upon this $1 bill again, and Esther's like, "I forgot to tell you." And this is her story. "When I was 19, I was a cashier working in a coffee shop in downtown Chicago, and I was dating someone. I just wasn't happy, and I just thought, how do people know the right person that they're meant to be with? How do they know who that is?" I said, "You know what? I'm not going to worry about that. I'm just going to put my name on this dollar bill, and the guy that gets this dollar bill is going to be the guy that asked me to marry him." And so this dollar bill he gave me, I believe, is the same dollar bill I wrote my name on, and I knew in that moment that we were going to be married. Interesting. Random dollar bill she throws out into the universe, and Paul, in the very moment he's thinking about getting more serious with her, discovers a dollar bill in his wallet with her name on it. What does that mean? Anything? It's interesting. Paul would say they've been married 18 years now. He would say this, "I don't read too much into almost anything. I just kind of move forward. And after she told me, I think I went through all the normal stages of whatever. And I just thought, what does this mean for us? Is there some sort of bigger thing we're not seeing here?" Good question. What does that mean? Paul and Esther are in front of you, happily married, 18 years. They say to you, what do you think it means that we had this dollar bill? What would you say to them? Well, it means nothing. Clearly your soulmate's meant to be together. Third story, it's August of 2001, and Elise O'Kane is a flight attendant. She's doing her usual duties, entering her schedule into the system. She normally flies from Boston to Los Angeles. And she accidentally enters in a wrong code, and somehow in the computer's airline system, she's bumped onto a whole bunch of different flights than she normally travels. And she notices that she makes a mistake, and she's frustrated. She tries to swap back into her regular schedule, and she's able to swap all of them back except for one. There's one flight she can't get back on, and that's her Tuesday, September 11th flight. Flight 175 from Boston to Los Angeles. The day, September 10th, before the trip, she tries one more time to get back on that flight, and she's working with the system, but the system freezes. By the time it unfreezes, she has missed getting back onto that flight by 1 minute. 1 minute. Instead, she's bumped back to her previous flight, so she's now flying Boston to Denver. The next day, she's taxiing on the runway, and the plane in front of her is an aircraft, United Airlines Flight 11. It would take off and eventually crash into the World Trade Center's North Tower. Then her flight took off, and then the one directly behind her was the one she was supposed to be on, and it was United Flight 175, the one that crashed into the World Trade Center South Tower. Her schedule had been messed up, and when she noticed the error, she tried to fix it, and even when she tried to fix it the day before, the computer freezes, she misses it by 1 minute, and it ends up saving her life. And of course, she's left with this big question, what does this mean? She'd escaped being on a doomed flight by these seemingly random errors that had occurred, and she's haunted by this question, what does it mean? So let me ask you, if Elise O'Kane was here, she said, what does it mean that these random things happen and I missed dying? What would you say to her? Does her story mean anything? Final story, Eric Gordon is heading out on a weekend camping trip. He's traveling south on Highway 101 in California. And he's with a friend, and they're traveling down the highway, and suddenly his friend yells out, Eric, look! And by the time he cranes his neck to take a look, there's an overpass, and he misses it. And his friend says to him, oh, Eric, you missed it. There was a goat standing on the back of a cow. And he was like, what? He was very skeptical. He's like, that's ridiculous. Goats don't stand on the back of cows. But she was insistent. You missed it. She said, you've got to turn around. You've got to see this. He's like, we're on the highway. I can't just turn around. So they argue in the car. Finally, she convinces him. He gets on the off-ramp, turns around back on the highway, gets off again, turns around, pulls over. Sure enough, there is a goat standing on the back of a cow. And the two friends sit silently. They're just looking at this odd spectacle. And the goat doesn't seem to care. The cow doesn't seem to care. They're just doing their business. And finally, they're like, we got a better look at this. This is such a strange sight. And so they get out of the car. But the moment they close their door, the goat hops off the cow. They're like, ah, we ruined it. They're like, maybe if we just stand quietly, it will hop back on. But while they're standing there, they notice at their feet a letter. They pick up the letter. It looks at least 50 years old. It's crisp, it's browned, it's postmarked 1952. And they look at it like, this is strange. And then they notice another letter, and another, and another. Hundreds of letters are right at their feet. They begin picking them up. They're calling out the dates on the envelope. There's some from the 1920s, 1937, 1890. In total, they pick up over 300 letters, and all of them are addressed to the same woman, Ella Chase. What started as two friends noticing a goat on a cow and now turned into the two friends standing in the middle of this fence by a highway with someone's entire life correspondence. They were unsure of what else to do, so Eric picked them up and he took them home with him, and he spent 10 years trying to track down the family of Ella Chase. There were so many stories in these letters, but he could never figure out who she was or family or relative. Finally, after 10 years of hunting, he enlisted two journalists to help him. And they went to historical societies, census records, libraries, checked microfilm. Eventually, they find one name attached to Ella Chase, Robert Lyle, her grandson. And when they finally get in contact with Bob, he's got a fascinating story to tell. 12 years ago, he was moving and driving down the highway with his wife, with all of his grandmother's correspondence in the back of his pickup truck, when suddenly a gust of wind blew one of the boxes out of the back of his truck. And he pulled over immediately because they're spilled all by the side of the highway. But right as he pulled over, a California police officer pulled in behind him. And in California, apparently it's illegal to pull over on the side of a highway. So the cop gets out and says, "You got to keep going. You can't be stopped here." He says, "But all my grandmother's letters are right here." And the cop's got no mercy for him. "Sorry, it's illegal. Keep going." He's like, "But I'm going to lose all my grandmother's letters." The cop says, "Well, if you want a littering fine as well, then keep arguing with me." And so Bob has no other decision but to keep moving forward. And he's lost this huge piece of his grandmother's life. And then, 2 hours later, Eric and his friend drive by and notice a goat on a cow. And when they pull over, they find all of these letters and pick them up. It all started with noticing a goat on a cow. Now, Eric would return the letters to Bob. Bob would, in turn, send him dozens of boxes of Ella Chase's letters, and they still carry on a friendship today. I want to ask you, though, what does it mean? Does it mean anything? Was it all just a lucky, albeit quirky, accident or coincidence? Or was there a sort of fate and destiny involved in these events? Well, let me bring these four stories together. Does Double Rainbow Man noticing rainbows and being caught up in wonder and beauty of the moment, does it mean anything? Or are those rainbows just nature doing what nature does? Or was there something more going on? What about the couple with the dollar bill? I mean, the odds are relatively remote. But Esther sending a dollar bill into the world and Paul ending up with it, I suppose it's not impossible. Fantastic, but not impossible. Does it mean anything? Or what about a lease? Scheduling errors and computers freezing, they happen all the time. Was it random? Or is there meaning there? Goat on cow guy stops, pulls over, discovers these letters. Does it mean anything? So I want you to think for a moment. How would you respond if they were sitting in front of you and said to you, "Seriously, tell me, I need your input. What does this mean?" How you would respond to that question, by the way, will tell you a whole lot about how you see the world. So stick with that moment for a second, because it'll tell you a lot about the way you see the world. But I will tell you how I would respond. I've had more time to think about it than the rest of you, but I would say this. I have no clue how stories like these happen. And how God works in the world is a complete mystery to me, but I tend to think this. I believe the Spirit of God works between the fuzzy lines of coincidence and causation, the obviously purposeful in the purely random. And so I have no idea if God caused these events to happen, though I'll tip my hand and say my hunch is probably not. And yet, I still think they have a lot of meaning. I still think they have a ton of meaning. How so? Well, summing up stories of coincidence, Sarah Koenig says this: these stories could probably be explained away with statistics and probability, but there's just a poetry to things like this when they happen. There's some kind of beauty in it. There's meaning in the noticing of it at all. I love that line. It's a little mantra for me now. The meaning is in the noticing. The Double Rainbow Man noticed his situation is the meaning of it. I mean, think of all of those four stories. If they don't notice it, there's no story. If he doesn't take out his camera and notice that, there's no story. If Paul misses Esther's name on there, there's no story. It's the same with all of them. There's no story without the noticing, and the meaning is in the noticing. Because all four of them, they could have missed it. They could have failed to stop. They could have kept driving. They could have just kept carrying on. And so for me, the meaning is in the noticing. And I would say this, this is where the Jesus path wants to take us, wants us to travel. The blessing prototype that we see in Jesus' baptism is a waking up and noticing this world is strange, profound, and mysterious. And that is the meaning. To be awakened to something more, to notice moments like these, tells us we're awake and growing and maturing. It's to be haunted by the mystery and the miraculous that's all around it. And so to have eyes to even notice things like these means we're awake. And that is how the Jesus path begins. Thomas Merton writes this, "Life is this simple. We are living in a world that is absolutely transparent, and God is shining through it all the time. This is not just a fable or a nice story. It's true. If we abandon ourselves to God and forget ourselves, we see it sometimes, and we see it maybe frequently. God manifests himself everywhere in everything, in people and in things and in nature and in events. It becomes very obvious that he is everywhere and in everything, and we cannot be without him. You cannot be without God. It's impossible, simply impossible. The only thing is that we don't see it." We often think of faith as a matter of belief. What do I believe with my head? But I want to tell you this morning, faith is actually a matter of perception. It's a matter of being able to see and experience God in the world. And if you look in the New Testament, how we see seems to be one of the major plot lines of Jesus' ministry. You follow the eyes in the Gospels. In Jesus, we come to realize, has come to restore sight, heal the blind. Jesus' primary mission, it seems, is coming to help us see. And the Gospels litter us with stories of Jesus healing, giving sight. Jesus says this, "Do you still not perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes and fail to see?" Jesus' path wants to change how we see. Jesus says this, "The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness?" To travel the Jesus path is to learn to see. I would frame it this way. To travel the Jesus path is training ourselves to spot goats on cows. And so we come to this blessing, this path of blessing prototype, and it has three components to it, Jesus' baptism. It helps us learn to notice and see, take genuine delight in others, and give parts of ourselves away. Now, in both the Old and New Testament, this is the prototype of blessing we find in Scripture. In fact, we find it in the very first story of Scripture, creation. In the story, of course, God creates the world, and at the end of each day, right, God looks upon what he's created, and he pronounces it as good. God sees what he created, takes delight in what he's created. God sees, God delights. But what we can easily miss in the creation story is that God gives as well, because what God does is give the world the creative potential to keep creating. God sees, God delights, God gives. This is the prototype for blessing, and I believe it's a way of life. We see this powerfully in Jesus' baptism story. This is how it goes. Then Jesus came from Galilee to John at the Jordan to be baptized by him, and John would have prevented him, saying, "I need to be baptized by you, and you come to me." But Jesus answered him, "Let it be so now, for it is proper for us in this way to fulfill all righteousness." Then he consented, and when Jesus had been baptized, just as he came up from the water, suddenly the heavens were opened to him. He saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him, and a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, the Beloved, with whom I am well pleased. Ooh. Prototype of blessing is right here. God's voice declares Jesus as his son. He's noticed. He's seen. Then God delights in Jesus. N.T. Wright translates this passage this way. You are my son and you make me very glad. For parents here, I think this is a beautiful thing to tell our children more often. It's easy to say, hey, I love you, I love you, I love you. But there's something different about saying, you're my child. You bring me joy. You delight me. God sees, God delights, and then we're told that the Spirit of God descends on Jesus like a dove, and Jesus is empowered. And this marquee moment in Jesus' life is profound, and two things are worth noting here. First, Jesus has done nothing. He hasn't healed, no miracles, no teaching. He's done nothing to this point in his life. He doesn't hear from God after, you know, feeding 5,000 people, and God's like, wow, now I'm impressed. That was delightful. No, Jesus had done nothing. You just delight me just because of who you are, without having done a thing. And second, Jesus had done nothing. What Jesus does is he internalizes this blessing and it shapes the course of his ministry. After Jesus' baptism, he goes to the wilderness where he's tempted. The very first thing he does when he comes back and starts his public ministry is what? He takes his own blessing that he's internalized and he pronounces it on others, particularly the marginalized. Very first thing he says, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, the persecuted. Jesus internalizes this, and it becomes a way of life for him. I know this to be true of me. Now my way of life is simple. I am to bless others. Jesus was seen, delighted in, gifted. He internalizes this, and his whole life becomes about seeing, delighting, empowering. But it all starts with the noticing. The meaning is in the noticing, and yet that alone seems insufficient. I would say this, the meaning is in the noticing, but the noticing comes with an invitation, and God is always present and at work within the invitation. What do I mean by that? Consider the stories we've covered so far. Double rainbow, dollar bill, doomed flight, goat on a cow. When we consider stories like these, I think it's very easy to ask ourselves questions like, where is God in this? Did God cause those events to happen? But I want to suggest that I think those are the wrong questions. We're looking for God in the wrong place. We're looking for God in the cause when I believe God is found in the invitation. Because here's the thing, if you look for God in causes, you're always going to end up being tripped up. If you said to Elise O'Kane, clearly God saved you, that gets problematic. So does that mean God doomed thousands of people? We look for God in causes, we get tripped up, but I'm convinced that God is in the invitation. And whether God causes some events or not, I'll be honest, I honestly don't know. But I'm confident that God is always in the invitation. What is the invitation of these stories? I find this fun. So this guy notices a goat on a cow, and then he's confronted with the letters on the ground. He's noticed, that's the meaning, but there's an invitation there. What are you going to do? Could have got back in the car. Could have let them blow away. Instead, Eric hears an invitation. You know what? I bet you somebody wishes they had these letters. And he spends 12 years hunting that person down. Or consider Double Rainbow Man. Paul, he notices the rainbows, so there's the meaning. What's the invitation? There could be many, but at the very least, I would say this. He's prompted to share his video with the world. And over 50 million people have seen it and found incredible delight in that. It's hard not to have a smile on your face listening to Paul Vasquez just go off on these double rainbows. And I don't know about you, but I could use more moments like that. And I don't care how silly it sounds. If I could be moved like that with wonder, my goodness, I'll take it. And in sharing that video with the world, this quiet, simple man simply reminds us, at least someone like me, you know what? This world is gorgeous. Or what about Paul and Esther? He notices the dollar bill. There's the meaning. What's the invitation? Well, he asks himself, what is the invitation here? It's, you know what? I think I want to move further into love and trust and commitment and fidelity. The invitation is you're being invited, Paul, to love deeper, to give your fidelity and commitment to a single person. That's the invitation. What about Elise O'Kane? She notices these crazy coincidences. How did she possibly, her life was spared? What does this mean? The rest of Elise's story is fascinating because, overwhelmed by these circumstances, she decided she wanted to give her entire life back, and she changed professions. She became a nurse, retired from flight attendant, became a nurse because she simply, given these circumstances, wanted to give back because her life had been spared. And so she takes the invitation and lives a life of service. See, delight, give. This happens at Jesus' baptism as well. God sees Jesus, delights in Jesus, gives Jesus his spirit, and the invitation there is Jesus takes it, internalizes it, and spends his whole life noticing, delighting, empowering, blessing. The meaning is in the noticing, but the noticing comes with an invitation, and I believe God is always active and present in the invitation. Where does that leave us, though? Because there's always like, oh, those are some interesting stories, Brad, but I don't know about you. Chances are we probably won't stumble over two rainbows while in Yosemite, or find a dollar bill with someone's name on it, or miss a doomed flight, or see a goat on a cow and discover 300 letters. Chances are we won't be baptized and hear the voice of God say, "You're a delight to me." These are massive events, the kind of stories that seem rare, right? But I use these because it's an illustration to me that I believe faith is a matter of perception. And I want to tell you that there are goats on cows everywhere. They're everywhere for those with eyes to see. They might not be this dramatic, but if our eyes are open with wonder, we'll find that there's goats on cows for us in life. I want to close with three just quick stories from most spectacular to least spectacular to show you how this works. I actually first gave at least half of this sermon back when we were in COVID lockdown. And I think I gave it out at the barn, and I was also taping weekly sermons online. And so that week, I drove out into farmland to find a goat on a cow. I thought, wouldn't this be amazing if I could film a goat on a cow while I'm preaching? It would be perfect. And so I just headed north and east. I was in the middle of nowhere. And I'm looking, and I didn't find a goat on a cow. But then I'm like, okay, well, I need a good spot to film the sermon. And so I see a farm with a windmill. And I'm like, oh, that might be a decent background. So I pull into somebody's farm. I'm like, they'll probably not notice me. I'm out in the middle of a field, whatever. I'm driving around trying to find for a spot, and I notice out of the corner of my eye a farmer. I'm like, you know what? I should probably just tell him I'm filming on the edge of his property, whatever. So I go to him, say, hey, can I film here? He's like, okay, whatever. Where are you from? He says, I'm Brad. I'm from Nexus Church. He's like, okay, do whatever you want. Fine. The Sunday morning I first gave this sermon, half an hour before I'm about to speak, I get an email. It's from the farmer. He tracked me down. And he said, hey, I hope filming went well, but I want to ask you something. He said, my son is gay, and in the circles I move in, they all seem to think he's going to the hot place. Couldn't even get himself to say hell. I think he's going to the hot place. Just curious, since you're a preacher, what do you think? Oh, I got my goat on a cow. Because I had noticed, and there was an invitation to just go and engage him a little, and then he tracks me down. And I emailed him back and said, you know, I think your son is completely loved. And I tried to write the nicest, warmest email I could. And I never heard from him again. But I thought if I could give that father just a second of reassurance, I've done my job. I noticed, I received the invitation, I did my task. Kind of spectacular to me because it happened on Golden Kaiser. Anyway, I loved it. But we go, okay, that's still spectacular. Okay, what about more little things? Here's one of the things I've noticed about myself. I have some ambition in me. And I didn't really realize that a few years ago, but I've noticed recently that there's some ambition in me. Notice, where's the invitation? Well, I'll be honest with you, I don't really know, because I think ambition is like a loaded double-edged sword. It can be good, because good work can come out of it, but it can also fuel ego and da-da-da-da-da. But to me, it's just a little thing. You notice something, and then you start looking for the invitation. That's where God is found. God is always found in the invitation. It's a matter of finding it. Or the most common goat on cow moments that happen in my life are simply this. It's usually when I'm praying, and someone's name will pop into my head. Just, huh, they came to mind. Goat on cow, because here's the thing. Like Eric, you can just drive along and go, whatever. And never notice, and never pay attention, and never pull over. But so often those little moments for me be like, I don't know why that person came to my head, and I don't know if this is going to turn out spectacular, but maybe the invitation here is to simply email them. I don't know. But I believe when we understand that the meaning is in the noticing, we can walk through our lives going, all right, I'm looking. And when we notice something, whether it's about ourselves, about others, look for the invitation, because that's where I'm confident God is. And when we find those moments, we're standing on holy ground. We're going to take this further next week. How do we live this out as a way of life? I want to take us further into that, but for this week, I just want to end there. The meaning is in the noticing, so keep your eyes wide open. And when you do notice, there will be an invitation. The question is, can we find it? Can we figure it out? Because faith is a matter of perception. I'll ask the band to come and close us. And I want to tell you, I'm convinced of this. I don't know how God works or acts in the world. Again, I'm pretty confident God works between the fuzzy lines of causation and coincidence. But there are goat-on-cow moments everywhere if we would have eyes to see. And if our eyes are open with wonder and awe, we'll find that there are goats-on-cows for us. So may you this week have fun spotting goats-on-cows. Band?